I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A report this year by the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank showed that the growth rate of businesses owned by black women has been faster than any group in the nation. In August, we asked the report's author why it matters, and we heard from local entrepreneurs about the challenges they face as black women trying to start a company. Today, we listen back and get their insights. Then a look at what it's like growing up in a presidential family. Clifton Truman Daniel and Lucy Baines Johnson know all too well, and they'll share stories that illustrate the good and the bad of having a president in the family. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The focal point of our first segment today might stun you. The point is this. The recent growth in the rate of business ownership by black women has been faster than any other group in the nation. That's right, the growth rate of businesses owned by black women exceeds that of white women or white men or any other group. And Missouri has the fastest growing number of black women-owned employer businesses in the nation. That may surprise you too. But black women who own these businesses are reporting that challenges remain, including access to capital. Today, a conversation I had in August about a report released this year by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City called Black Women Business Startups. With us is Del Gines. He's a senior community development advisor for the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank, and he's author of this study. Del, nice to have you.
Hey,
welcome.
Nice to be here.
Dion King is the founder and CEO of DMK Results. That's a consulting firm specializing in leadership training. Dion, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Katina Taylor is also here. She started Dreams KC to re-engage students in the educational experience. Katina, good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Del, how surprised should I be here that Missouri has the fastest growing number of black women-owned employer businesses in the nation?
Well, you probably are as surprised as I was when I found wrote it in the report.
Can this be right?
Yeah. But it is right. I mean, this the data comes from the survey, Census Bureau Survey of Business Owners. And the time period we used was 2002 to 2012.
Yeah.
So when we started ranking them all, which initially I wasn't going to do, but I thought it would be interesting just to see and show people. It did kind of surprise me that Missouri was. And we don't know why. I think that some of that
question.
Data requires more research to be put behind what I feel is a dramatically under-researched field.
Yeah, Katina, you surprised by that?
No, I'm not. I think that Missouri and Kansas City in particular over the last several years has really begun to work on building an entrepreneurial ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And so with that, there has been some intentional outreach, support, development that wasn't there when I first got into entrepreneurship back in 2000. Do we still have work to do? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have we come a long way? Yes, we have.
You know, Dion, I just can't wonder if there's something sociological going on here. I mean, what do you make of this? What's your sense of why this is?
That women, black women, are leading in this area.
Yeah, in job creation.
Honestly, I always take it from a cultural perspective. I just had a chance to tour the African American Museum that's in Washington, D.C., and had an opportunity to learn how entrepreneurial pursuits have been part of African American women culture. And so I just think that now we're starting to see the numbers. Now we're starting to acknowledge the efforts. I, too, was surprised. Once I saw the data, it felt good. But yeah, this is something I think culturally has been part of what we do.
Do you know why this is? Do you have any theories as to why this is?
I don't have a theory yet.
I'm paying money for theories right now
because
I'm struggling to understand
Dale,
this myself.
You have the numbers. I mean, perhaps that could kind of give us. But I just think that being able to carry the community and do our part, making sure that we continue to stay creative and that we're monetizing that.
Mm-hmm. Katina, tell us about your entrepreneurial path. How did you get to where you are with your company, Dreams KC?
Well, it's certainly wasn't a straight path, that's for sure.
Yeah.
My dream had always been, and I always said that I wanted to be an attorney, and so that was the path I took from kindergarten all the way through. Never changed, never deviated. Have no idea where that came from, because neither of my parents were in that field. Once I graduated law school, I left Kansas City, actually, spent some time in L.A., and then came back home, and decided I didn't want to practice law. And so I had always been doing event planning and things like that. So some friends said, hey, explore that as a career path. Bills still need to get paid. So in 2000, I launched my own event planning business, and that was my first entrepreneurial endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
But no one told me, and I didn't have the tools to understand how quickly or slowly, I should say, you generate profit and can maintain yourself in entrepreneurship. And so I was like, I have to do something. I had a small child at that time. So I actually responded to a call to a teacher shortage in the Kansas City Public Schools. And went in, fell in love, realized that that was a purpose and a passion for me. And so the last 18 years really have been devoted to education. About 5 years, I walked out of the classroom because I couldn't continue to participate in a system that, in my opinion, was not serving students well.
Hmm.
I couldn't go to sleep and wake up and participate. And so I was an empty nester at that time. I said, everyone around us is creating schools except educators. That didn't make sense to me. And so I said, I wanted to start Dreams KC, which would be a school to actually serve students well, because I knew how to do that.
So is Dreams KC a charter school, or what is it?
So we have not launched full scale as of yet, actually. We've run two pilots, but it is a school within a school model. That's the way it's pitched. It'd be community based and developed. And so we're in talks and in the process of raising funds to launch full scale.
Pretty ambitious.
Absolutely.
Doing your own school.
Why not?
When do you hope to launch it?
I hope to launch next year at some point.
Yeah.
So we'll see. You know, got to raise that capital, and that's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
So I've seen several schools come in the time that I've been working on it. None of them have been founded by Black women. So that's a part of this conversation that we're having.
Dion, how about your own path, your entrepreneurial path, as you've worked to found and lead DMK Results?
Actually, it's DMK Consults.
Consults.
We are an executive leadership consulting firm, and primarily we focus in on diversity and inclusion initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
Can I be honest with you?
Yes.
Entrepreneur is not what I had in mind. That is not something that I sought out. I think it was a result of three things. One, and my background has always been in law firm diversity. So this is something that I've actually built an expertise in, and that means creating strategic data, creating strategic plans and initiatives for large law firms that had both national and international presence. So that's the experience that I brought. But I started to experience diversity fatigue. That's what we call it in this field. It's just a burnout. And so
What is diversity fatigue?
Diversity is fatigue is where you burn out. You get tired of what you're doing. You don't see the needle. You don't see the shift in culture and many of the initiatives that you're trying to put in place. It seems like they're stagnant. And so many professionals that do this work for years and years and years will experience this fatigue. And then I also, there were two other things. I was starting to get a lot of invitations to speak at other conferences and to help other law firms to show them what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So my plans were blueprintable. And so I was able to share that. And I realized, wow, I'm wanted more so outside of the firm than I am internally.
Yeah.
And so I just saw a decline in the value I felt of the work that I was doing in a particular firm, and just decided there was more of a pull from the outside.
So for you, what was the big trick, the big challenge in starting your own company?
As you said, there were a number of challenges. For me, it was scaling, understanding some of the business concepts. I was fortunate. I've only been in business for 2 years, but my very first year, most of my business was, I would say 98% of my business was through referrals. So I had really built up a strong strategic community to where I was able to lean on that, and I got a lot of support in that way. The challenge is just understanding, well, first of all, capital. I use more of my savings than I would have liked to.
I bet every entrepreneur in the world can probably say the same sort of thing.
Yes. So I didn't want to do that, but, you know, you have to do what you have to do. And so understanding that the build relies on me having better education about business and how that works. And then doing all of that, teaching myself while I'm in it, and trying to still build a book of business.
So when you launch and you look back on it now, are you surprised? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how naive you were about what you were getting yourself into here?
Yes, because like I said, this is not something I sought after. I enjoyed working for corporate America. I enjoy a paycheck on the 15th and 30th. Yeah. I enjoy good insurance and expense accounts and all the good things.
And you gave all that up.
I gave all of it up. I jumped in with both feet, and I scaled down my life to make sure that everything that I do lines up with the vision of creating this consultancy, this DMK consultancy, because I realized there really is a need for what I do.
But maybe if you had to do it over again, you would have spent some time learning more about business and some of the basic concepts.
Absolutely.
Of what you were trying to do.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Katina, how about you?
The wherewithal, so to speak, not that others don't, but I was like, where do I start? I did ask that question. And so I was able to reach out to like Casey SourceLink or Fast Track through Kauffman and some of those other resources that Kansas City has back even in 2000. They look very different today, but some of them were there then. And so I was learning to work on my business as well as in my business while I was building my business, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a tricky proposition.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? A scary proposition, maybe.
Definitely.
Yeah. And Del, nothing you're hearing here is going to be surprising. These are pretty typical stories based on what you write in your report.
Yeah, I've heard it over and over. I mean, both of their stories are reflective of the conversations that we had in the focus groups. And then since I've been out doing the outreach and listening to more women tell their stories, it's remarkably consistent. This, the lack of general knowledge prior to start, like, you know, one of the things, quotes that I have, the very first, in fact, is that quote that says, you just got to do it. Like one of the women said, you just got to do it. And that's what we hear over and over. But then what they're saying when it comes to challenges is the lack of general business knowledge prior to start. So they're jumping, you know, like the LinkedIn founder says, an entrepreneur is somebody who jumps out of an airplane and builds a parachute on the way down. That's what black women are doing. They're just happen to, the materials that they just have to have when they jump out is just like a toothpick and a napkin. So,
but most experts would say that's not exactly the smartest way to go, as you're suggesting here.
Well, it's the entrepreneurial way to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most entrepreneurs do. The difference is that different demographic groups of entrepreneurs have different resources when they jump out,
mm-hmm.
or prior knowledge of how to do things when they jump out of that plane, when they start, that seems to not be available at the same level in the marketplace for African-American women.
Yeah. You know, Katina, you jumped out of an airplane. You just heard Del say it with a napkin and a toothpick. And what were you thinking, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I will say that I was in a different position than maybe some others. I looked at the numbers. And so most black female entrepreneurs are between the ages of 35 and 54, I believe, the first time they reach out. So for me, I was an empty nester when I went full scale and just left the workforce. So I was an empty nester. I was not married at the time. I did meet the age requirement, but my decisions only impacted me and my dog at that point, right? So when you have young children, that may be a different. If you have a spouse that you're accountable to, that may be different. So the process is going to look different. But
so you could justify the gamble you took, is
absolutely,
what you're saying.
Absolutely, yeah.
No one else was being impacted if you were making a series of really bad decisions.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but at the same time, we do have to look at that culturally. If you don't have anyone that trained you for this path or doesn't, you don't have someone that you can have mentor you or coach you or anything of that, then we do have limited resources because we don't even have a narrative.
Yeah.
Anything to start with.
We're talking this morning, if you're just joining us, about the rapid growth rate of business ownership by black women. It's a faster growth rate than any other group in the nation. What about this idea here, Dion, of the lack of capital that came up here? I also want to talk about the lack of mentors. Mm-hmm. How about for you? Was there a mentor that you could turn to? Or again, were you sort of doing this on your own?
Yes, I think my experience was different than what Dell captured in his report, I am surrounded by a very strong group of mentors and those that I would say are sponsors and really kind of can help me. So I think throughout the process, it's nothing for me to pick up the phone and get the contacts and get the information that I need. Now, if they're passing out checks, I still haven't created strategic alliances with those type of people, and that would probably be part of my plan. But as far as mentorship, that's not something I lacked, and I'm very happy to say that's been something I've really leaned on in the last 2 years.
Katina, mentorship for you, did it exist?
Not at all. I've cultivated that along the way, and ultimately what I have found is that I've become the mentor and the coach for many that have come behind me. And so then I have to be very intentional about making sure that I'm seeking out coaches and mentors that can guide me as I increase my work or grow in my work.
So recommendation number one, or very close to the top, Dale, might be something like the need for more African-American mentors to help women like these two right here.
It doesn't have to be African-American. The feeling was very mixed on that. Like, mentoring was very important. Some said, yes, I would love to have an African-American female be my mentor. Others said, I don't care. They could be an alien. Mm-hmm. As long as they can...
They know what they're doing.
As long as they know they could come down from Mars, and as long as they knew how to help me.
Right.
And so, but the general theme was that, you know, mentoring, we would love to have more mentors, people that could help us navigate through the process, that we can call out to, that can kind of help us figure out where we're at, because they've been there or they've seen it enough before that they can say, don't make this mistake, think about this choice or things like that. Because we're just not seeing a lot of that in the market.
Yeah.
Can I just say something else, Steve, just piggybacking on that, because I know this was a big discussion when you had us to sit down and talk during our focal group. We really have to be intentional about creating our mentorship space. And that's not something that just organically grows for many of us. And so I think there's a part as business owners that we play in crafting our own, what I call Dion's board of directors, and making sure that I do have strong mentorship and people in it that do not look like me, but that are successful in what they do and are able to provide the guidance and motivation in some respect that I need. But we have a responsibility to be proactive in building our team.
Are there networks out there in Kansas City now that folks can tap into?
Absolutely. Yeah. We have the Multicultural Business Coalition that exists. That was founded by Adrienne Hayes of the Seed Law Group. I myself and some fellow black women who are entrepreneurs just put together what we call the Women's Mastermind Group. And we get together every other month and we talk about, first of all, we share what we do. And then we make an ask of the group. And then the group brainstorms ways in which to help that particular entrepreneur meet that need. And that may mean making referrals. It may mean some coaching. It may mean whatever it is that we can do to assist them in the gaps that they're having. So some are going to be formal. Some are going to be informal. The need is there. The need is great. We just need to make it happen. And that also is going to require many of us to tear down. And Dion and I talked about this. Some of our cultural barriers. Some people have been trained, like, you don't ask for help. That may look like a sign of weakness, or you may look unprepared. But I've looked at some of the white females or other groups of people, and they come in asking with expectation. They've been trained to navigate that space, and they don't see it as a sign of weakness. So some of that is going to be kind of demystifying or tearing down some of those cultural things that we've experienced.
That's true.
You know, Dell, what about another big issue here that's come up is which the lack of capital. That's a conversation that would apply to any group of entrepreneurs you could ever have. How big of an issue is that? And I gather it goes without saying it's a big one, right?
It's a big issue. Like, all the research on minorities in general show that the capital barriers are there. But we do a national small business credit survey through the Federal Reserve Bank system. And so in that report, I asked them specifically to give me a comparison of black women employer-owned firms with non-black women firms. And, you know, the disparities are stark. Only 40% or out of all black women asked with employers, they asked for funds. Only 40% of them got the funds that they requested, compared to 25% of other groups. So 4 out of 10 black women who requested funds, these are employers, so they had some business acumen, got none of the funds that they requested. And it's the same across all the other variables from those results. So it's a huge thing, and it's a barrier in two particular ways. It's not so much a barrier to start. It's a barrier to scaling, and it's also a higher predictive of failure rates when you don't have that capital that you need to grow.
Yeah. Your report also points out that Black women often found themselves frustrated because family members wouldn't agree to support them until they were able to prove some ability to succeed here. Katina, you're laughing. Does that ring a bell?
No, you know, actually it doesn't. My family, my friends, my network in and of itself, be it small amounts of time, be it small financial donations, whatever I called upon them. And I think that's just because I've given so much to those people in my network that they didn't have a problem giving back to me. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't necessarily been my experience. Now, if you're talking about what I need to launch full scale, then that's a different story. They're not willing to possibly give that, even if they had access to it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a challenge for sure.
Dion, is it?
Yeah, it's the same for me. I definitely had support from my family, but my family is not my target audience. And so I also realized that going in. They definitely do the you go girls, give me the pat on the back and the support that I need emotionally. And I know that that they would be there if I had a need and wanted to ask them. But for the most part, that has not been my target audience. So
Del, some context here. What percentage of female-owned businesses these days are made up of Black women? Do you know off the top of your head?
The total percent is 15%. Black women are the only group of women that are overrepresented compared to their population. So Black women represent 13% of the female population and own 15% of the businesses.
And what percentage of Black-owned businesses do women, Black women constitute these days?
That would be 15%.
And then
of the Black businesses, it's 60%. So Black women are also the only group of business owners that have more female ownership than their male counterparts.
Really,
so 60 to 40. It's very unique.
You know, one of the issues you came across, and I thought this was really telling, was that many of these Black women-owned businesses are small.
Very small.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's a wide variety of things. One, you know, we talked about some of it is an issue of capital, startup capital. Two, it's also an issue of many of these businesses are small part-time. Like the average Black woman-owned business, they work less than 39 hours in their business. Mm-hmm. So it's a part-time type, you know, business. And so usually you're seeing them, you know, like a Dion would work at her job, but then she'd also start her own business and be doing both at the same time. So obviously you're spending less time on the business as you're either growing it or you're just using it to supplement your household income.
Mm-hmm. That ring a bell, Katina?
Not for me. You know, I took the leap of faith and I just jumped out there and was like, I have no idea what's going to happen, but God will provide.
You jumped and you're still falling.
I'm still, right? Absolutely. And so it was a full-time endeavor. I went into it knowing full well that it was going to be a full-time endeavor. But again, I see that a lot of my counterparts do. They need the insurance. They have small children or spouses. They have some other people and situations and circumstances to take into consideration. And so they're not willing to give up some of those securities.
Yeah.
And I understand that. But, you know, building capacity, that's why some people are still working full time in other careers, and that access to capital and those types of things is that they cannot just walk away.
I can't help but notice, Del, that what Katina just said, the report notes that faith and religious beliefs were important factors and sources of motivation for these women. Dion, you're laughing. That's, you know.
A lot of prayer.
A lot of prayer. And
that's, and as you know, culturally, just that's where we come from. That's our center point. And being able to go back to that center point for the strength that we need. I know that prayer was something that really was an uptick for me. I started praying a lot more. So, yeah.
It's funny how we find religion at moments like that, right? Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. But when you have that toothpick and that napkin, you need some prayer too.
Yeah, last thing. To what extent do many Black women, I'm wondering, feel limited as to the types of businesses they can run?
I think it's just a natural function of the environment. They're building businesses based upon what they know or what they see. And so a lot of these are service-based businesses, regardless of the sector. Like I put in the report, 68% of all businesses are in three of the, I believe, the 14 industry codes. So very heavily concentrated. And most of those businesses are, you know, take limited capital. You can start with very limited resources. You just have to have the will and the ability to sell. And so they're getting in those spaces.
So there's a lot of room to run here in Kansas City. If Kansas City wants to reach out to Black women business owners, the upside might be pretty telling.
It's huge. I've been telling this around the nation. I mean, you know, I've been talking in detail that if you want to transform local economies, especially economies in black communities. Prioritizing the growth and scalability of black women on business will be the fastest way to do that, period. That's my opinion, not necessarily the Federal Reserve Bank, but my opinion, looking at the data, looking at the communities in which we've had this conversation. If you can do that one thing, you're going to transform multi-generational lives in black communities and ultimately the city or the state economy as a whole, I feel.
Is capital the most pressing need?
No.
Is it the number one?
Nope.
What is it?
It's support. It's really getting behind this, building ecosystems with a high level of intentionality to support the growth, scalability, and diversification of black women on businesses. Because if you do that, the you'll figure out ways to get the other functions in place, like capital, support, mentoring, all the other things.
And are those efforts underway in Kansas City right now?
We are. I'm working with the EDC now, the Economic Development Corporation of Kansas City, they're trying to launch a minority accelerator and do a much better job in the marketplace for women and minorities as a whole, but particularly African-American entrepreneurs.
So we're going the right way.
You are. I think, in my opinion, in all the cities that I've been around the district, you're probably a little ahead of the curve.
Okay, that's good to know for once. That's great. That's Del Gines, a senior community development advisor for the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank, author of the study we talked about. Dion King joined us too, founder and CEO of DMK Consults, a consulting firm specializing in leadership training. Katina Taylor started Dreams KC to reengage students in the educational experience. Thank you all for a very good conversation. Appreciate it, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you,
Thank you so much for having us.
Pleasure being here.
That conversation originally aired in August. Coming up, we meet two members of one of the country's most exclusive clubs. They are presidential descendants. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, former Kansas Senate President and political moderate Dick Bond shared his views on today's Kansas political scene. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Greg Eklund is back to talk about the college football playoffs, even though they won't include teams in Kansas or Missouri. We'll get an inside view on how those selections are made on tomorrow's Up to Date. Well, Clifton Truman Daniel is the oldest grandson of President Harry Truman. Lucy Baines Johnson is the younger daughter of President Lyndon Johnson. That makes them part of an extraordinarily exclusive club of descendants of presidents of the United States. Lucy actually lived in the White House, and 55 million Americans watched her get married. Her first night in the White House, she and a friend lit a fire in the fireplace that quickly got out of control. The incident made headlines around the world. Clifton was in the first grade when he discovered that he had a grandfather who had been president. Together, they've got lots of stories to tell, and we're about to hear some of them now and again later this week when they're in town. Lucy Baines Johnson is an American businesswoman and philanthropist. She serves as board chairwoman and manager of LBJ Asset Management Partners. She joins us today from KUT in Austin. Lucy, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be with you.
Clifton Truman Daniels, a former newspaper writer, editor, and PR professional. He plays President Truman in the one-man show Give 'Em Hell, Harry. That's the first time in history that a U.S. president has been portrayed on stage by a descendant. He's the honorary chair of the Truman Library Institute. Clifton joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Nice to have you again, Clifton. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Lucy, was it a blessing or a curse to be descended from an American president?
Oh, it was very much a blessing. To be able to be an eyewitness to history is an extraordinary privilege for which I will always be grateful. Now, it came into my life unexpectedly when I was just 16 years old in the most tragic way possible. And so I would be misleading to say it didn't have its moments of challenges when I looked at it more through the problems that it presented to an adolescent rather than the gifts that it presented to an adolescent. But I was very fortunate. Before my father's term in office was over, I was able to look at it through the prism of historic privilege and to recognize just what an extraordinary blessing had been mine.
And you're suggesting that your father became president on the assassination of his predecessor, that was John F. Kennedy.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Clifton, how about you? Blessing or a curse?
Blessing, mostly. I'm a little more insulated than Lucy.
Right.
I'm a generation, another generation removed. And my parents and my grandparents did not play up the association very much. You mentioned earlier that I found out that my grandfather had been president in school. My parents hadn't even told me. The joke being, thank God it was first grade and not high school. And
no question.
I went to school that morning, and the teacher said, wasn't your grandfather president? And I said, I don't know. And I went home that afternoon, and my mother loved telling this story. I went home, dropped my book bag at the front door, marched across the living room, put my hands on my hips, and said to my mother, Mom, did you know that Grandpa Truman had been president of the United States? And she said, yes, but just remember something. Any little boy's grandfather can be president. Don't let it go to your head.
So that's a very Truman-esque thing to say, I think.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Well, you two had such very different experiences. You know, Lucy, you already mentioned this. You were living in the White House as a teenager. You rebelled against it a little bit. Clifton, as you grew older, you embraced the legacy as something you were drawn to. Lucy, tell us about that. You rebelled. Why?
Well, I wanted to be like most adolescents do, accepted by my peers and like everyone else, and to feel like I was being befriended because of who I was and rather than who I was related to. But that experience caused me some isolation in my adolescence, I think somewhat. But for the long run, as I indicated earlier, I realized that the opportunities to be an eyewitness to a history were far more meaningful to me than any of the inconveniences that it had offered. I was sadly that wedding that you referred to earlier that was watched by so many people. It was a very youthful wedding, and my former husband served nobly and selflessly in Vietnam, and after he came home, things were really not quite the same, and like they were for many marriages, and unfortunately it did not survive. But I think the long view of it from my perspective was, oh gosh, what an extraordinary gift it was to my life. And for that, I will always be grateful.
Did you really almost set the White House on fire that first night?
There was the first night that we moved into the White House was December the 7th, 1963. I couldn't understand initially why my mother had responded to my father with, oh, please, could it be any other night but that? I didn't have the long view of history yet. Did not immediately put two and two together and recognize that we were being asked to move into on the day that shall anniversary of the day that shall live in infamy for that generation always.
Pearl Harbor,
of course,
right?
Bombing of Pearl Harbor. But my parents had been really working practically 24 hours a day since November 22nd, and this was their first moment to have just a few hours off. They went over to a good friend, staff member's home, Walter Jenkins. His daughter came right over to be with me. I looked at the magnificent fireplace that was in my room and thought, oh my gosh, this is luxury at its penultimate. I asked my girlfriend if she knew how anything about fireplace flew. She said she thought she did, and that with an emphasis on the word thought. And short version is we lit the fireplace. The flue was not totally open, partially, but not totally. The room was engulfed in smoke immediately. I tried to put it out with a small juice glass that I found in my bathroom, and that was obviously not sufficient. I eventually found a trash can, filled it up from the tub and got it to douse the fire. Mind you, I had been in that room, you know, no more than about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So my familiarity with it was, grossly inadequate. And so I climbed up on the desk that was mine in front of the mammoth windows in the north portico, managed to open it up to let the smoke out, look down and realize that there was a White House policeman standing straight underneath me and that I had my nightgown on. And, of course, I was mortified. And I spent that first week in the White House helping to
clean the smoke clean off the walls.
The smoke off the walls.
I read that.
Margaret Truman tried to do with her children and letting them know that they had not been elected to this position and they were just fortunate to be onlookers in an intimate way to history. Nothing that they had done had given them any particular acclaim. My mother wanted to make sure I recognized that, and so I spent the time cleaning off the walls.
And from that day forward, you refer to the White House as the Great White Zoo, right?
Well, I did for a short period of time in my adolescence. I think by the time we left permanently, I was 21 and my husband was serving in Vietnam, and there'd been a lot to help me come to terms with the extraordinary opportunity that was mine, and to see it through a different prism than rather than just its limitations on a youthful figure.
I was
married and divorced. I've been divorced and had four children before I ever went out alone on a date. It definitely had its impact. But one of the wonderful stories that I'd like to share about its impact was December of 1968. We are moving out of the White House, and I'm wanting to reach out to all the figures that had impacted me over those years and to say thank you to so many who had been so extraordinarily kind. And one of them was Clifton's grandparents, or two of them were Clifton's grandparents. Mm-hmm. And I had a picture of my son and myself on a front of a Christmas card. And I recognized that the Trumans and their very humble perspective on life really had no staff or no significant staff, and at Christmas time, the Christmas cards that they would be receiving would be being largely handled by volunteers. And I hope that a picture of me and my baby and me in the front of the White House might make some volunteer realize that they ought to get this into the hands of the Truman if they could. And like, you know, millions of Americans, I wrote a little note on the back of my Christmas card. But this little note on the back of my Christmas card was to the Truman saying thank you to them, because so many people had offered to be of help to my parents after President Kennedy's assassination. But President and Mrs. Truman had been of invaluable support,
right,
because they truly understood, and I was forever grateful. On my wall, I pass it every day of my life and treasure it deeply, is a handwritten note from Bess Truman thanking me for the handwritten note on the back of a Christmas card to them.
There you go.
And I think that tells a lot about who the Trumans were, and I think it also says a lot about how first families feel about each other. There's a communion of, you've been there, you understand, you care, you value my efforts, I value yours.
What's life like as a presidential descendant? That's our topic here. The Truman Library Institute will present a program featuring Clifton Truman Daniel and Lucy Baines Johnson. It'll be at 6:30 Wednesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. This program is free, but RSVPs are requested. More information on the Truman Library Institute website. We're visiting with Lucy Baines Johnson and Clifton Truman Daniel. Clifton, you've made a little history yourself in that you portray your grandfather on stage in this one-man production called Give Him Hell, Harry. Why did you decide to do that?
I think the short answer is at the end of lectures, I also lecture on my grandparents and White House history. And in the last several years, at the end of lectures, people were coming up afterwards and saying, hey, you're kind of getting to look like your grandfather. And I'd known that the show was out there. I saw it. I saw a recorded version, James Whitmore doing it back in, oh God, I think I saw it, 1976 on an airplane. It was the movie on an airplane ride. And it was just something I was interested in. And friends encouraged me. And finally, a friend of mine, Tony Rivenbark, is the executive director of the Thalian Hall Center for the Performing Arts in Wilmington, North Carolina, where I used to live. Tony said, let's do it. So we did the production last October and are now trying to go forward and book it for the 2020 season. It's a weird, weird retirement.
And how do you think your grandfather would have felt about you doing what you're doing?
Oh, God, I worry about that every time I open my mouth on stage.
Do you? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you try your best to get his voice, to get his mannerisms right, to be true to the character. But I think about it every time I go out there. I think about it when I'm rehearsing it in my living room.
Yeah. You know, Lucy, you talked about the whole idea of Secret Service agents being with you all the time. And, you know, again, when you went to the White House, President Kennedy had just been assassinated, so security was a bigger deal then. How was it for you having a Secret Service agent everywhere you went at the age of 16 and 17?
Well, they became very close friends. In the beginning, there was a temptation, I must admit, to see if I could find a way to get away from their ever-constant protective sight. And I was fortunate. I had a very wise and friendly and good agent who came to me and said, Lucy, I don't know, I'm not making any accusations, but thought has occurred to me that the thought might have occurred to you that you would like to ditch us at some point. And I just like to let you know I have a 2-year-old daughter. If you do that while I'm in charge, it'll probably cost me my career and her livelihood.
Hmm.
And so I just felt like I ought to share that with you.
Wow.
Well, you know, who, wow. The idea of taking food out of a baby's mouth simply because you want to be more independent made it real clear that that was not a decision that was one that I could or should embrace.
You know, when President Kennedy was killed, a student burst into your Spanish class and announced that the president had been shot. Your father, Lucy, was in that motorcade as well, but the student didn't say anything about your dad. What went through your head?
Well, I was absolutely terrified.
Mm.
I was terrified on multiple levels. I was terrified because President Kennedy was my president, as all the other students were terrified. I was terrified because President Kennedy was my father's boss, as I sort of singularly, along with my sister, was terrified. And I was terrified, most importantly, because President Kennedy was my friend. But in addition, I knew that Governor Connally was in that motorcade, and he was my Uncle Johnny, and we had lived next door together and played together and prayed together, and he'd been on my father's staff, so we were very close. His daughter had been my sister's dearest friend. And then, of course, the whole recognition that nobody said a word about my father. Not even when we got down to the gymnasium, which also served as our chapel, and the announcement was made about the injury for President Kennedy and for Governor Connally. Only when I got out to the quadrangle after we had been dismissed, and I was sort of wandering in a haze, did I see a Secret Service agent who was on my father's staff that they had sent to see me, and he came rushing towards me, and I went rushing the other direction as if I could outrun a member of the United States Secret Service because I didn't want to hear what I knew he had to say.
No, boy.
And he ran and grabbed me and held me and said, I'm sorry, many times, and I beat on his chest saying no, 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 and finally, you know, he wasn't saying what I'm sorry was all about, and I wasn't saying what no is all about because the words were, frankly, unsayable. But after I got my composure, I asked him about my Uncle Johnny, and he said he was expected to live. And I asked him about my father, and he said he would be okay. And said, I guess we have to go tell the headmistress and then go home. And he said, absolutely, and we did.
Wow. Truman, you said that you realized that after talking to other children and grandchildren of presidents that most of them have a similar outlook. They've concluded that it's sort of a two-part job. What are the two parts of that job?
Well, the first is to do what you can to preserve and protect and expand, if you will, your ancestors' legacy. You know, through a lot of us through the presidential libraries and museums. But the second part of that is to take that legacy and sort of make it your own. Do what you can with it to make things better in any way that you see fit. For me, that took the form of visiting Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 2012 and taking part in the memorial services on August 6th and August 9th that year, and just sitting down with more than two dozen survivors just to let them tell us their stories. And my son Wesley and I returned the following year and recorded about a dozen of those stories for the Truman Library and Museum so that researchers, filmmakers, historians can have firsthand accounts of the bombings to use in whatever productions they're doing.
You know, Clifton, you tell a story, it's a great story, about how accessible your grandfather was as an ex-president when obviously you knew him. A man had a blown tire on Delaware Street. That's a street right outside of your parents' home in Independence. Right. And the man went up and knocked on the door. Tell us what happened there.
He knocked on the door, and my grandfather answered, and the guy said, I've got a flat. Can I use your phone? And Grandpa said, sure, come on in. And the guy called the local garage, and the garage owner told him it was going to take him a little bit to get over there. And so the guy hung up and turned to my grandfather and said, thank you, I'll just wait by the car. And Grandpa said, don't do that. Sit down, relax. And they talked for a few minutes. They just sat down in the living room or stood in the front hall and just got along just fine. And finally, the wrecker pulled up out front, and the man thanked my grandfather again and walked out the door. And he got halfway down the front steps, and he stopped. And he turned, and he looked back at my grandfather, and he said, you know something? And please don't take offense at this, but you look a hell of a lot like that SOB Harry Truman.
Yeah.
And my grandfather just smiled at him and said, I am that SOB.
Just like
only
that.
That's only the initials weren't what was used.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, Lucy, we have about 30 seconds left here. At some point, you once said, I learned that I couldn't control what other people thought of my parents, my sister, or of me. Now I just try to do what I think is right for me. That sounds like it was a hard-earned lesson.
Well, the only person you can control in life is yourself, and the sooner you learn that, the better off you are. But I had an opportunity as my father's daughter to campaign in 26 states and to try to thank those good people who had worked so hard for my father and who believed so much in what he was trying to do, and I got a chance to know him firsthand. And I also got a chance to travel and meet President Truman and other heads of state, to be an eyewitness to history and some of the most exciting days of America's life.
Lucy, I've got to scoot on
here. Civil rights change.
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary privilege.
Lucy Baines Johnson, Clifton Truman Daniel. Again, you can see and hear both of them 6:30 Wednesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information on the Truman Library Institute website. Hey, thank you both for a great conversation. I appreciate it.
And a happy holiday to you.
Happy holiday to you.
Happy holidays.
You bet. We've been talking about housing in Kansas City for decades, so when are city leaders going to stop talking and start doing? We'll talk about that tomorrow. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.